Okay, well, I've been tasked or arm twisted or whatever you might say to do our survey on the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me just start by reading the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, sort of get us in the right frame here. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor, in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south, and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually, and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Okay. So, by way of providing some transition from Alan's class last week on Job, I was thinking that the one thing the books have in common is they're considered to be hard to understand. Okay, and this is supported with respect to Ecclesiastes by Matthew Henry. He says, there are indeed many things in this book which are dark and hard to be understood, and some things which men of corrupt minds wrest to their own destruction for want of distinguishing between Solomon's arguments and the objections of atheists and epicures. But there is enough easy and plain to convince us, if we will admit the conviction, of the vanity of the world and its utter insufficiency to make us happy, the vileness of sin and its certain tendency to make us miserable, and of the wisdom of being religious and the solid comfort and satisfaction that are to be had in doing our duty both to God and man. Okay, so that's sort of a 17th century take on Ecclesiastes. I found a more recent book by Michael W. Kelly. I think it's called The Burden of God. The Burden of God. And he noted that it's a strangely fascinating book. Its seemingly inexhaustible supply of quoted and quotable sayings or aphorisms captivates minds for whom moralistic platitudes provide the only certainties. The book's stock phrases crop up everywhere among a diversity of authors in various literary contexts and for sundry purposes. One encounters references to them in works of history, psychology, philosophy, social theory, and novels, to mention but a few. In short, the quaint sayings of the book of Ecclesiastes are broadly familiar to our modern cultured elite to various literatures, and are not the sole preserve of theologians and Bible scholars, or even of writers of exclusively ethical concerns. Their terse formulaic expressions can easily lend themselves to proverbial dicta and moralizing axioms. Where they are not reproduced verbatim, they are often appear to convey, in approximate words, the gist of what it is they are thought to mean. How familiar they are, and how readily they come to mind. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There is nothing new under the sun. And so on. But he says, in spite of our acquaintance with the clever aphorisms of Ecclesiastes, the book as a whole remains an incomprehensible mystery, one huge conundrum smack in the middle of Holy Scripture. And then for many Christians, the seeming negativism of the book of Ecclesiastes is especially troubling. As a result, like the purveyors of modern moralism in general, when they cease to moralize from the book, not knowing what to make of it otherwise, they usually avoid it altogether. The explanation for this state of affairs is not far to seek. It stems from the preconception which many Christians have of what the, quote, gospel message contains, and in their mind, the book of Ecclesiastes does not convey the same message. At best, Ecclesiastes is a preparation for the gospel's good news, but not itself a bearer of that message. The problem, however, goes much deeper than this, for the concept of the gospel in many people's minds seems a very humanistic one. Its lofty content has become man-centered and subjectivist, experientialist in nature. I'll skip a little bit, but he says, once we view our personal experience as paramount, the gospel content is bound to become nothing more than a means to gratify the experience. And, skipping ahead, when our experience is measured by our perceptions and not by what God tells us it should be, it stipulates how we come to the Scripture as a whole. We unavoidably place conditions on what we think it must say. Christians have come to insist that God's word should be immediately practical, i.e. a suitable elixir for nourishing self-esteem, a tonic for emotional tedium and feelings of boredom and alienation, a delicious narcotic for the vexations of modern mass existence. And I guess without reading the going on to read it, which it's interesting to read, but as you can imagine where he's going with this is the reason why Christians aren't that interested in the book of Ecclesiastes. Anyways, if you're interested, this is actually online at the Contra Mundum website. So, okay, well, let's start with the title. In order to start with the title, we have to talk about the author. So we'll do the title and the author. So the author of the book calls himself Koheleth, rendered in our version in the New King James Version as the preacher. This is the only place in the Scriptures where this word appears. It says that it is just created for the book itself. It's thought to stem from the word kahal, which means to assemble or gather together. So it's thought to mean someone who participates or convenes an assembly. And quoting from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, worked out on this basis, Koa seems to mean citizenship, or concretely a citizen of such respectability that he is entitled to participate in public assemblies. It is in the character of citizen king that the speaker in Ecclesiastes relates his experience and presents his ideas. Skipping ahead, the word for assembly and its cognates are in the Greek, translated by ecclesia and its cognates. And then skipping ahead some more. So we are not surprised to find Koheleth rendered by the Greek Ecclesiastes and this Latinized into Ecclesiastes. Okay, so the root of the title, if you were wondering where it comes from. Okay, so now that we completely understand the title of the book, we'll go on to less sure and more controversial matters, namely, who wrote the book. The author refers to himself, as we already mentioned, as Koheleth. It's usually translated as the preacher, although if you look back to what we just said about it, it's clearly not the preacher in the same sense that Bruce is the preacher on Sunday mornings. Right? So it doesn't come from a root from that kind of background. I think the NIV and a few other translations render it the teacher. Okay. So, on the basis of verse 1:1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, and a lot of description within the book, says the preacher was wiser than anyone who came before, and so on. Most people have taken the book to be the work of Solomon. In fact, I didn't ask our Sunday school superintendent, but I presume that's why it's scheduled to be now. Right, okay. So, the internal evidence for Solomon being author is the preacher was incredibly wealthy, starting with chapter 2, verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. He, as I mentioned, he was very wise. Says that he was wiser than all who came before, and that is definitely one of Solomon's attributes. God said he would not only make Solomon wiser than anyone came before, but also than anyone who came after. let's see. The preacher of the book wrote many proverbs, Ecclesiastes 12:9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. Okay, so I think you can see the basis for Solomon being author is, you know, it's fairly clear. According to one writer, everyone, or, you know, he quotes Jewish commentators and church fathers, thought the book was written by Solomon until Martin Luther. Okay, and Luther thought it was written later. But even after Luther, most of the reformers, Puritans, and later conservatives held this view. So I was somewhat surprised when a number of years ago I was reading this book, and I'll recommend this to you. This book is called Looking for the Good Life, The Search for Fulfillment in the Light of Ecclesiastes by Gordon Keddie, who is a pastor in the RP Church. We did a study on this. I bet it was it 10 years ago? I mean, it was a long time ago. Anyway, so when I was reading this book, years ago, he offhandedly mentioned that the book wasn't written by Solomon. So let me just read to you just a little bit from this. Koheleth, having established the general theme that everything under the sun is utterly meaningless, begins to speak in the first person. He speaks from personal experience. More pointedly, he comes at us from the viewpoint of Solomon, putatively the wisest man in Israel's history. The reason for this literary ploy is obvious. Who could gainsay the words of such a man? To invoke Solomon was to assert unchallengeable authority. In modern terms, Solomon was the, quote, expert. He was the man with the most distinguished personal bibliography in the field of practical wisdom. Solomon was Mr. Wisdom Literature. Koheleth uses this literary device quite openly and honestly. He is not that great king of Israel, but he speaks as he is led by the inspiration of the Spirit of God as Solomon Redivivus. Reborn, I guess. He is the second Solomon. Both the man and the century are different, but the teaching is the same. And so I read that, and then there's a little note, a footnote in the back, which just actually refers us to another book, discussion of this device. So, anyways, so in preparation for this class, I went and looked into this whole business of authorship a little further. However, I'd like to put a disclaimer here in true Oki speak, which is, I don't have a dog in this fight. Okay. The idea... The idea that it was Luther's idea, it was adopted by some, I'll say, conservatives, in other words, people who held the Bible to be inerrant, but it was later also taken up by some liberal German theologians, you know, sort of higher critics, and so to some degree, some people might hold the opposite view purely on the principle that if it's held by a liberal German theologian, then probably the opposite is correct, which, you know, isn't altogether a bad way of looking at things. Okay, so, but let me just give you a little more background here. Some internal evidence for it not being written by Solomon. First of all, the book doesn't claim to be written by Solomon by name. Okay. So, I mean, if it did, then, I think we would absolutely have to accept that. Yet the book doesn't specifically claim that. That's not proof that it's not, in a sense, not written by Solomon, but at least leaves open the possibility that it's not. He says he's the son of David. Of course, the son of David here may be a descendant. The phrase, it says he was king in Jerusalem instead of king of Israel. And this suggests that he wasn't actually king of Israel as a whole country, but rather king after the kingdom was divided. Or it was written after the kingdom was divided, when the kings of Judah were often referred to as king of Jerusalem rather than king of Israel. a number of the words that are, I think, the biggest reason actually why scholars look at this and think that it's written later is because a lot of the language appears to be much later than Solomon's time. So even back in 1644, Hugo Grotius wrote, "I believe Ecclesiastes is not the production of Solomon, but was written in the name of this king as being led by repentance to do it, for it contains many words which cannot be found except in Ezra, Daniel, and the Chaldee paraphrasts." So a lot of the actual language appears to have come later, after the exile. And some people also think the themes come from after the exile, after when the Israelites were being tempted, I guess, by Greek philosophies and so on. Also, some of it clearly wasn't written by the preacher itself. I mean, the preacher's in third person. From chapter 12, verse 8, "Vanity, vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge," and so on. So, it's possible the author compiled it later. It's possible it's partly a literary device. Perhaps it's compiled partly from Solomonic source material. Perhaps not. I don't know. We're going to call the author of the book the preacher. So, but I thought that might be of interest to some of you. Okay. So a little bit about the themes of the book. In fact, that's all we'll have time for, is a little bit about the themes, a little bit about the outline, and then we'll probably be done. So, okay, so to some degree, the book, well, it's certainly an antidote to hubris. This first comes across as all is vanity, or at least everything under the sun. Those are really sort of a theme and maybe a motif of the book. So starting with the vanity, this is the Hebrew word hebel. It basically means wind or breath, but it connotes vanity, senselessness, transitoriness, right? And if we look, let's take a look at a few of these. There's passages, there's a long list of things that that he applies vanity to. It includes, just starting with chapter 2. If you read chapter 2, there's a discussion of the author's experiences. I've read parts of it already. But then later in 2:17, he says, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Leading up to that, he discusses pleasure. "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this also is vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish?" Starting with verse 4, I've already read this. "I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards." He did all this sort of building of his estates and accumulating property. It was all vanity. Knowledge, chapter 2, verse 12. "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly, and what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all." Okay, so while, clearly knowledge here has some benefits, in the end, it's vanity. Wealth, of course, some of the stuff we read in chapter 2, he gathered himself silver and gold and so on. It's vanity. That also shows up again in chapter 5. Verses 8-15, where he talks about the oppression of the poor and the profit of land and... verse 10, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. He who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity." Verse 11, "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes?" Work, verse 17, "He hated life because of the work that was done under the sun." Verse 18 of chapter 2, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Success, certainly the preacher was very successful. That, yet he says, better in chapter 4, verse 13 to 16, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. He could be the most, come from the humblest origins and become the most successful person ever, and those who come after will not rejoice in you. Let's see. Youth is vanity. It's chapter 11, verse 10. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Let's see. Frustration is vanity. Chapter 4, verse 4. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Let's see. Loneliness, chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor, for if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. There's some other actually familiar verses there. We'll leave that aside. Death is vanity. Chapter 3, verse 19. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to dust. Okay. So this aspect of the book, that everything is vanity, well, clearly among other things it can be misinterpreted. This part particularly though might be thought of as pre-evangelism. Might be thought of, as Francis Schaeffer said, removing the roof, or blowing the roof off, as I used to like to say. If this life is all we have, right, we're fooling ourselves to think any of it's meaningful. And that's, you know, to a large degree, that's the dilemma and the problem of modern man. And postmodern man. Well, you can fool yourself all you want. I guess modern man probably realized that he was in this despair, and that's why we can have postmodern man who can dream up other things to try to fill this vacuum. If for the person who believes that they came about just as a result of chance and time, there's no reason to believe anything is meaningful. I mean, just look. And I think that is an important part of the message of Ecclesiastes, right? It's all vanity. This is confirmed by Paul a couple places. Ephesians 2:12, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. 1 Corinthians 15:19, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men the most pitiable. Now, Paul's not saying that people who don't believe in Christ but don't have anything else to believe in aren't pitiable. He's just saying we'd be the most pitiable if that's all we had. So another theme, or maybe a motif of the book, is life under the sun, S-U-N. So if I counted right, the phrase under the sun appears 29 times in Ecclesiastes. So just a few places, 1:14, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. 2:11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. 5:13, there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, which is kept for their owner to his hurt. So in fact, this concept of vanity is largely tied to under the sun. Right? And maybe I should have had a marker board today, because I was to say from this perspective, it is only with life under the sun, and that's S, capital S-O-N, in other words, under Christ, that we find meaning. But under the sun, you know, and I think we could pretty easily think just of sort of an evolutionary, secular evolutionary viewpoint, where there's nothing more than what we see physical surroundings, right? Everything's vanity. So from that standpoint, you know, we can really only find meaning in life if it's under the sun, under God, and from His perspective. Now, I don't want you to construe this to mean that when an unbeliever becomes a believer, that life goes from being completely meaningless to always feeling meaningful. I mean, Christians will certainly feel life is meaningless, or parts of life is meaningless. Right? I hope if you you probably noticed it, that you've done things then thought, what a waste of time. This was completely worthless. If you're a college professor, you know some of your lecturers were probably like, why did you do this? You get the exams back and you see no one paid any attention. Yeah, right. So, and Christians are often tempted to find our meaning apart from God. Should be no mistake about that, no delusions that we aren't tempted to find meaning in our work or in other things, that are apart from God. That's vanity. Right? So, I mean, from that standpoint, I think this is an excellent book for Christians to read. It helps give a God-centered perspective on life. I also don't want you to construe that the book, that when I say only with life under the sun that we find meaning, under the S, capital S, under Christ that we find meaning, that the book doesn't have anything to offer the Christian, right? It is a reminder of God's sovereignty, His omnipotence, our impotence. The fact that given this is a fallen world, we often feel meaningless. The book recognizes this fact, but encourages us to enjoy the good things that God has given us. Okay, so another one of the recurring themes, and I think this is a very important one, is in essence, what is our response to this as Christians? And that is that I would say the themes are working and enjoying the fruits of our work, the good things that God has given us. So Ecclesiastes 2, starting verses 24 to 26, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 13, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Chapter 5, verse 18. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, that is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joys of his heart. Okay, so this theme, there's four chapters in the book it appears in, right? It appears throughout the book that we should enjoy the gifts of God, enjoy the fruits of our labor, and yet it shouldn't be confused with hedonism. You should not confuse that with eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Right? A hedonistic philosophy. If you turn to chapter 11, right, verses 9 and 10. Told, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. Okay, so if you stop there, you might say, Well, that's sort of like eat, drink, and be merry message. But it doesn't stop there. It says, but know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Right? So, it's not a hedonistic philosophy, and it does call for self-reflection and so on. But it's as believers, we can enjoy ourselves. We can enjoy the fruits of our labor. It's a good thing, a gift from God. It can be taken too far, and if our work takes the place of God, or if our enjoyment of our work takes the place of God, right? That's vanity. But there is a place for that. Another theme of the book is that sprinkled throughout the book are proverbs of sorts, wisdom. It's wisdom literature, right? And it comes up throughout the book. And I've not tried to criticize or not tried to bring out everything here, but just I have a selection of things. The first part, Ecclesiastes 4, verses 4 to 6, which is on fulfilling your vows. This is one that I think it's good for us to reflect on. You know, I mean, in one sense, if you read up to this, did I say 4, 4 to 6? I'm sorry, that should be 5, that's 5, 4 to 6. Right, if you read before that, maybe I'll start with verse 2. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. So, and then it goes on to, when you make a, well, let me read, I'll read 4 through 6, and we'll come back to. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say because before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? So, I mean, it's certainly, part of this is certainly to be careful about the vows that we make to God. Right? I don't want to neglect that, but in our lives, at least for most of us, the main vows that we make, maybe, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but maybe we're not all tempted to constantly be sort of trying to bargain with God and promise him something, which, you know, that might be one application of this. We do make vows, we make promises before God as part of life, and some of the important ones that we do make, right, for most of us, are our marriage vows. Another ones are our covenant of church membership, right? Now, for officers of church, there's another set of vows. And there may be more, but those are ones that come to mind is that they're, not universal, but within the adults of the church, they're universal. just about, you know, for everyone who's married, made some kind of marriage vows, and all the members of the church made vows. So, you know, it's something we have to do both think about carefully before we do it, and then also be very careful to keep it up, even to our own hurt. And I think in both cases, these are vows we're tempted to neglect by reason of overfamiliarity. Right? I mean, you make your wedding vows once, but you know, then you go live with your wife every day for 20-some years, you know, in my case, that's, you know, so what you're saying, I've been out of town for most of that time. you know, it's we're very familiar, you know, and it's we're tempted to forget, you know, we made certain vows about our marriage. Same thing with church, with the covenant of church membership. We made these vows. We've been in the church a long time, but we don't keep going back and thinking about those vows. But, you know, the message here is very clear. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Don't let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Well, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have made that vow. That's one area. The other three I've titled The Importance of Hearing Criticism, The Importance of Not Hearing Criticism, and The Importance of Not Criticizing. It's somewhat of a play on words. I don't believe they're at all contradictory, but in certain senses you could title them this way. So Ecclesiastes 7:5, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Right? So this is important. It's important as a Christian. You may be rebuked for something that you've done that's wrong. It's important in my professional life. I often am rebuked. There's two things that come to mind. One is student reviews, you know, where I get comments back. And now, of course, there's some question of whether that fits. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. But okay, so we have to be discerning, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I still think, I think it behooves all of us who are in this sort of position, whether you're a professor or an employee, and you hear criticism of your work from people, it's very good for you, even if it is to carefully consider whether or not it is a rebuke of the wise or not. The other thing is, of course, I submit published papers and books. And they get reviewed by, in many cases, anonymous reviewers, and you get these comments back. And of course, often your first response is, "Well, this guy does not know what he's talking about." You know, I can remember one time a colleague and I, Dr. Fisher, submitted a paper to a journal. It was the first time we'd ever submitted one, and we got the reviews back, and the letter said, "Well, we think the paper is probably worth publishing, but." There's quite extensive comments. And these two reviewers had written like 12 pages. 12 single-spaced pages of comments on the paper. My first reaction was, "Oh, I don't believe this." I start looking at them. And after we went through and we said to each other, "Well, you know what? These guys are right." And in fact, I know who, you can sometimes tell who they are. In one case, one of them admitted it. In the other case, I just know who it was. And they both, I believe, really meant well for me and Dan. And the end paper was much, much better. But they had to say these things. And we had to consider, in this case, the rebuke of the wise. So I titled the second one, The Importance of Not Hearing Criticism. That's Ecclesiastes 7:21 and 22. Also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart is known that even you have cursed others. All right? And this is the thing that we have to not take all criticism to heart. Because people often say things. I know from reviews and from paper reviews and student reviews, people often say things they wouldn't say to your face. They often say things that they could not, it wouldn't justify, but maybe make them feel better. You'll sometimes overhear people saying something. You may even mishear it. Or you may misunderstand it. I think that's very often the case. People, I know a lot of people, particularly people who are somewhat bitter with life, who seem to misunderstand everything that's said. Right? And to me, this says, besides, it's the importance of hearing the criticism, right? It's important not to take it to heart and get mad at people for things that they say. We have a sort of an onus to give people the benefit of the doubt, to sort of try to understand where they're coming from, not to get angry, and so on. So, even though that getting angry is often our natural temptation to do so, and sometimes it's maybe, I'll say, more legitimate than others. There is righteous anger, but let's face it, usually most of the time it's not righteous anger that we're feeling, is it? It's unrighteous anger. Okay, and then I said the importance of not criticizing, which is actually all these things are consistent with each other, but this is really the flip side of Ecclesiastes 7, 21, 22. So if we go to 10:20, do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. This is very, very wise. I mean, wise point. And, of course, as the author says, in effect, doesn't exactly draw this out, but first of all, not cursing the king or the rich, even in your thought. You know, what starts out in your thought life often, speaking for myself anyways, inadvertently comes out in my speech life, since I often say the first thing that comes to mind, much to my regret later on. And and as it says, the word may get back, and it may cause that person to have unrighteous anger, and you don't want to start that, especially with the king.
Isn't that by definition
That depends on the king. Not necessarily. Not in all cases. So, let's see. Okay. Also, of course, in many cases, our cursing the king is also cursing God's providence, right, in many cases. And that's, you know, cursing our situation. So often we're not, people aren't saying you're not saying to yourself, oh, I'm cursing God's providence or his sovereignty, but in fact, that's what you're doing, right? So, that's another reason not to do it. Okay, there's plenty of other great pieces of wisdom in here, and as I read in this introduction to this book by Michael Kelly, you know, these are often even just picked up elsewhere. That's sometimes thought of as the only value of the book. Okay. Wow, we're running out of time already. Hard to believe. Let me just give you a quick outline of the book. And this could be outlined more than one way. This is not the way that the New Geneva Study Bible outlines it. This more or less follows this book by Keddy. So if we start, say, chapter 1, verse 1 to 2:23, it's basically, as Keddy says, the spiritual bankruptcy of secular under the sun living. Of course, this returns to this theme again, but the first chapter and the first 23 verses of the second chapter are basically that. And then verses 24 and 26 come back. I've already read this, but it's nothing is better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw is from the hand of God. So it's kind of a contrast, life under Christ instead of under the sun. Right, but then in chapter 3, he then returns again to the vanity of man's life under the sun. Okay, and right, so chapter 3 is this well-known passage, which well-known, I think, because of Song by the Birds, a time to be born, a time to die. One shortcoming of Keddy's book is he recognized the song, but he didn't seem to know who it was by, if you can imagine. If you can imagine that. Oh, we like to feel smug, don't we? Okay, so God ordains everything, but man cannot see it. See, if we skip down after this, a time to be born, time to die, time to plant, and so on. Verse 9, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Okay. Part of the point of the book, one of the reasons why everything is vanity for life under the sun, is that since God ordains everything, but we're only human, we can't see it all. If we're believers, you know, we may understand more of God's work. We do understand God's work, but we're still human. We're still finite. We still don't comprehend a lot of things. You know, there's a lot of questions. Why did God ordain something? I don't know. I mean, we just have, in a sense, we have to trust in Him, and we have to obey His instructions. You know, in this case, we have to live our lives and go on with them. And amongst other things, eat and drink and enjoy the good of our labor. Okay, in chapters 4 through 10, then, he repeats the theme, life under the sun is vanity, God is sovereign. Even believers cannot always discern His ways. So there's nothing better than enjoying God's gifts. And it's interspersed with, as I mentioned, practical proverbial wisdom. We've kind of gone through, you know, bits and pieces of it piecemeal. So the last two chapters, then, 11 and 12, are really the challenge to us. And I'll say to live our life to the fullest under Christ. And if we I'll skip over the explanation of verses 1 and 2 about casting our bread on the waters, if there's a discussion in Ketty of that. But if we go on to verses 3 through 6 of chapter 11, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. I won't go into it any further, but you know, on a verse-by-verse basis, but I guess you could say, or my way of looking at this is, we're basically challenged to you know, live life, you know, to go out and basically live boldly, not hedonistically, but to go on and live life, to work, you know, and we don't know all of God's plans. And if we spend all our time worrying about what, you know, in a sense, about what God's plans are specifically, right? You know, you could become morbid introspectionism in a sense that we never do anything. We're just paralyzed by fear, right? And I think the message of this book is that, you know, we shouldn't, I mean, amongst other things, we shouldn't be paralyzed by fear. One of God's instructions to us is to, you know, work boldly, you know, in a sense here, invest. We don't know what's going to pay off completely, and enjoy the fruit of our labor, and, you know, appreciate the fact that God is sovereign and has everything in His hand. And we don't know. We don't have to worry about everything because we're not sovereign. It's not our, in one sense, it's not our job to worry about everything in the universe. Okay, verses 11:9 until 12:8. Then. I subtitled, Don't Wait Until You're Old. And I've already read some of this. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. Okay. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 8, then, the author goes on basically to tell us that later in life, you need to remember to create your Creator now while you have a chance, that you cannot put this off until later in life. And if some of you probably have personal experience with this, of knowing people who, in a sense, have hardened their hearts and, you know, basically had some feeling that they'd be able, if they were going to do anything with religion, it would be later in life and so on. Find out is, of course, that what happens is our hearts keep getting harder. By the end, it's too late. You know, they can't read. You can't, you know, your mental faculties diminish as you get old. Your ability even just to read and so on diminish. That's if you're grant, in one sense, if you're granted a long life and don't die suddenly. So, don't wait. Okay, finally, verses 9 through 14, the conclusion of the matter. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, this is 12, 9 through 14, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails, given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. To that, I think I can just probably say amen. That really sums up the message of the book. We're just about out of time anyway. So. Any questions or discussion? Mr. Carroll.
Years ago, you weren't reading this when you proposed to Mark. No, but I was thinking of it.
Marriage proposal, vanity, vanity, everything's vanity. Mr. Covington.
I like verse 4 of chapter 9. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion.
Yeah, there we go. There's many things like that, and that's not a phrase still used today in one form or another. So, anything else? Okay, well, why don't we stop there? And Dave, would you close in prayer?